Welcome into another episode of Big Talk College Sports with Midwest Perspective, Blue Collar, and Blue Blood. I'm Dalton Shetler alongside my partner Sam Sprunger. And off the top, I'd like to issue an apology because I woke up with congestion that hit me harder than the Heidi put back hammer.
the highlight of the second half.
Yeah. So you're going to have to deal with a little bit of a congested voice, Dalton. But we're here nonetheless.
It's fine.
But anyways, we bring up the Heidi put back hammer. Of course, that was a part of the national championship game. You could see Sam lighting up. And of course, if you're new to the program, Sam has an allegiance with Purdue. He's very interested in Purdue athletics and roots and has been a lifelong Boilermaker fan. But let's just focus on, before we even get to dissecting the game and everything else, the emotions of what that national championship game were Monday night for Boilermaker fans. Because, again, context, if you've been missing out, this is the first Final Four that Purdue's made since 1980. It was 44 years since Purdue had made the Final Four. Last time they were in the national championship game was 1969. I mean, it's amazing when you take a look at how long Purdue had went to being on this stage for it to finally happen, and you get to witness it, live in it. What was that like emotionally for Purdue fans?
Well, first off, I will be 45 in August, so I'm 44 right now, Dalton. So that tells you that I was all of about eight months old when Purdue was in the Final Four the last time. This was and we kind of relived my actual interaction at the Elite Eight, you know, and the cutting down and celebration. But having them play actually in the Final Four was something that I told my neighbors after they won Saturday, I actually have a reason to stay up until 9:20 for the tip. I've never needed to watch the national championship game up to that point. So it was an experience that, you know, I can get used to. You know, if it meant that Purdue was going to make a national championship appearance and maybe win one occasionally every few years, I'll take it, because the endorphins that were in just coursing through you while you're watching them play defensively against North Carolina State. Because North Carolina, I tell you, I did a Sam's Big blog on this. North Carolina State played a great defensive game.
Mm-hmm.
They played great. And Purdue still beat them by 13. So they Purdue could play defense. Now, I expected a better different, and I'm not going to break it down, but I expected a different, showing from Purdue on Monday. But you know what? The fact that we were there, we were performing, and yes, I say we, I don't play on the team, but it's we. I've put enough emotion and support in there that I'm part of the we. But the fact that we were playing on Monday night, that I had a different analysis of UConn, and UConn was just a different animal, you know. But the fact that Purdue was there, Zach Edey, don't care what anybody says, he is by and far the best player in the country this year and last year, because what he did against the best defensive center in college basketball, what he did against him on Monday night just proved that I think actually that Zach Edey was the best defensive and offensive, best overall player in college basketball.
Well, let's go ahead and start breaking it down then, and kind of use that as a springboard to get into, because UConn wins the title game 75-60.
Convincingly. Good Lord.
Uh-huh. Now, I have plenty of thoughts on this, but I'll let you start, Sam. What did you take away from the game? What were your overall thoughts?
Well, here's what the simple analysis was, well, Purdue's other role players needed to hit more shots. They didn't have shots to take. That's correct. The killer thing is, you know, all these teams have a great game plan to play against Purdue, but they don't have the horses to fulfill that game plan. UConn had every bit the horses, plus then some, to be able to operate their plan of attack. When you've got the athletes and the ability to execute every aspect of your plan, you're going to win by a lot. Purdue by and far was the second best team in the country. I'm not going to try to sugar. I will not even argue, because I don't think you have a leg to stand on if you want to argue with me. Purdue by and far was the second best team in the country. UConn was just that much better. It was unbelievable to see how their role players played horribly against UConn, but yet they didn't. They just didn't have the shots to take, and they were giving Zach Edey everything he wanted. You know, basically, well, let's take it this way. They were giving him the ability to score points, and Zach Edey was taking advantage of it and hitting some really hard shots against some really good defense.
Sam, I would like to give you the official Dalton Shetler sticker of you know ball. Like that's I've had Thank so you. Many discussions since that game, and that's exactly it. And look, UConn is just that much better. When their guards are 4 to 5 inches taller yeah. and more athletic than yours, look, I mean, Sam nailed it on the head. The discourse has all been about how the Cavalry needed to step up and help Edey and come help Smith.
Couldn't do it.
You're not wrong, but they could not create shots. Lance Jones, Fletcher Lawyer, they could not create shots against UConn's perimeter defense. And that's not a fault of Purdue as much as it is just how dang good UConn yeah. is, yeah. how overwhelming they are. I mean, they basically said, look, we got a 7'2" center. We're going to stick him on Edey, and look, we're never going to double, and the outside shots just won't come. That's why there was – how many attempted by halftime? Like three?
They
two?
Attempted three at the half and only had hit one, and then they – I believe they went 1 of 4 in the second half. So, like, they went, like, 2 of 7 the whole game.
I mean, UConn basically just said, look, you can score 60 points in the paint, and we're going to make you work for all 60 of them. Like, you got to play your best to get those 60 points in the paint, yep. and you're getting nothing on the perimeter. And there's just not much you could really do about it when a team is that good as UConn and puts the clamps down. I mean, there weren't shots there. And Purdue, as good of a team as Purdue is, and this is not a knock on Purdue, but normally college basketball teams have weaknesses. And right. I would say one of the weaknesses of Purdue is that they don't have shot creators outside of Zach Edey. And so throughout the year, I mean, Purdue hits from the perimeter, and they're one of the best three-point shooting teams in the country because Edey gets a double, kick out, three. Like, that's how the system works. If a double doesn't come, Edie's got to take the one-on-one. Mm-hmm. And eventually, tough twos is a tough way to win a game. But again, that's not a bad game plan from Painter. It's not no. anything like that. It's just UConn is that overwhelming.
Well, and most of the time, the team you're playing isn't going to have the scoring capabilities that UConn has on top of
Correct.
That defensive capability because, you know, the Matt Painter even said it in the Elite Eight after the Elite Eight game against Tennessee was our offense is designed to go into the big man and evaluate what they're doing defensively before we decide what we're doing offensively. He said that's just the nature of our beast. When you have 7'4 down low, you go through 7'4 down low. When he's that talented, you go through him first and give him right of first refusal, even if it's just touching the ball and kicking it back out. He, you know, that was the thing is the court presence of Zach Edey is amazing. For a big man like that, I think he learned a little bit from Trevion Williams when he was around of being able to see the court no matter where you're at, see every aspect of the court because he, as soon as he gets the ball, if he feels that there's a double coming, he looks to find the open man. And they do a what is it called, reposting too, mm-hmm. to where they'll dump it down to him, try to get a quick read of what the defense is doing, kick it back out, and then they kick it right back into him because if the double comes, that's great. They know it, so they get it to him. When the double comes, he kicks it to the open person. That is their offense. Well, yep. UConn wasn't moving off of their outside shooters, so Edey was taking the shot, which is the design of the offense. Well, when you're doing it 96% of the time down the court, A, you get tired, and B, you're not hitting all your shots.
Absolutely. And again, like, Klingon made it hard for Edey. Edey mm-hmm. ate in that first half, but those were difficult shots.
Like, but I tell you what, he was eating Klingon alive. He was possessed. Like they were saying, he's the best defensive. This will be the best defensive or the hardest defensive test Edey's seen all year, and he had 16 at the half. Like he managed that best defensive defender he's played all year with ease. And I say with ease because they were giving. Sorry, Klingon, you're going to be on him 1-on-1. You know,
and I'll say with ease in terms of he was hitting shots, but I felt Klingon made it difficult.
Like, oh, sure.
There were some baby hooks. Edie showed some moves in that championship game that I'm not sure we had seen through most of the year just because Klingon was into his body. That goes to show more just how good Edie is and why he's the back-to-back National Player of the Year. But nonetheless, like, if that's the game plan presented against Purdue, it's like, hey, Edie's got one-on-one. They're going to be tough shots, and you're not going to get anything from the outside. Like, UConn was able to execute that, and I don't really know what else you do. I remember, like, late in the second half, and I was on Twitter scrolling as the game was being played, and everybody was like, they need threes. They're down. How are they going to get
threes? You can't take them when you don't have them.
And UConn's defense was just that good on the perimeter that they were not able to create any outside shots. It reminds me a little bit in a different way, kind of a reverse perspective of it. In the NBA a decade ago, when the Golden State Warriors were really at the top of their game and you said, how do you beat them? You run them off the three-point line. If they take twos, that's cool. Because
we'll let them beat us on twos.
But you can't let them beat you on threes. And UConn said that, okay, same idea. Instead of it being a backcourt heavy focus thing, though, like the front court's what leads Purdue. But you know what? If you score 37 on tough twos, hats off. But yeah. I think we'll be able to score at least 60 points on our side and win the game. And that's how it played.
And I think it was Grant Hill that made the simple adjustment You know, Lance Jones and Fletcher Lawyer, all the three-point shooters, instead of trying to drive to the hoop, they just need to slide step. Well, that defense was sliding with them. Like, they tried to do that. They just couldn't do it. And that's not me making excuses for Purdue. That's me saying I totally underestimated. I knew UConn was really good. I knew they were. I knew it would be a very difficult game for Purdue to play, but I didn't anticipate that suffocating of a defense to go along with the offense, because that's just it. Purdue can play great on defense. They can play great defense, but when they have to play great on offense on top of that, that's where they didn't have the horses that UConn did to be able to stick with it.
Well, and UConn's five tool, right? Like, they got sure. five dudes that are averaging double figures, and right. Purdue's got great players. Zach Edey's phenomenal, and Fletcher Lawyer, great player, but he's a spot-up shooter type. You know what I mean? Like, everybody's got their own skill set where UConn is more amorphous. Like, they just are – they can kind of mold and fit in whatever. Mm-hmm. That's so unique. Like, basketball teams are not normally built that way. UConn is just so unbelievably unique and good and produced kind of like a produce an elite normal basketball team in terms
right.
of, hey, we got a floor general, we got a spot up shooter, we got an athletic guard on the wing, we got a dominant post, we got a stretch four, like, that's it. Like,
and let me tell everybody that's listening that or is watching, this is not a one trick pony from Purdue. They're coming back. They're not rebuilding after this year. They're reloading. They've got six incoming freshmen that they've got to figure out one position, one scholarship to get rid of or to redshirt or something in order to fit all six of these new freshmen. And they've got the 11th best recruiting class coming in. They're not rebuilding. They're coming back with a different set of just weapons that they didn't have prior that are completely different from what last. They're not going to be as dominating as Zach Edey was. I think they're going to be extremely effective and very good in many different ways, because if Wilberg does come in and it takes over that starting spot, he's a different 7-plus footer. He shoots. He drives. He's got a different game and a skill set than Zach Edey, but you're still dealing with 7 foot, you know? So there's a different dichotomy, I guess, of this Purdue makeup after this year that's going to make them equally as good and as much of a threat as they were this year.
Well, so this is what I'd say, because I think you're right. Like, whatever we see next year, it needs to be an adjustment. I just wouldn't say equally as good, because the production level we just saw this year was historic.
I think equally as good, meaning it's going to win just as many games, maybe not to the 35 or whatever that they won, or 34, but they're going to win 28, 29 games. And it's going to be because they've just got horses now. They're not going to have the one. They're not going to have the one dominant player. They're going to have a few players that can step up and score 20 points on an average, you know, a couple of nights in a row. And then the next night, you know, the next one's going to do it. And then, so they're going to have a much different makeups, but they're going to be just as present at the top of the Big Ten, I guess, is what I wanted to say.
Okay. So, yeah, I would say Purdue absolutely is in the conversation as we do our way too early in April of being at the top of the Big Ten conference. I agree with that. My point just is the production load we just saw this year from Purdue and single-handedly how much of it Zach Edey carried. Like, that's correct. A big void. And I do believe you're right for sure. That people will step up and help out carry that load and split it up in different pieces because you can't just ask one person to carry that load that Zach Edey's been carrying. But to bank on it is we just don't know yet is how right. I feel. We got to see how this all meshes over the offseason. But if I do got to say, if there's a coach I trust to make adjustments systematically to what he has, it's Matt Painter. So mm-hmm. I don't lack faith. I just don't know that I will just rubber stamp Purdue wins.
Damn it, Dalton. I'm a Purdue fan. I'm going blind into it, okay?
Well, and so much of it too is, look, one of the discussions we have to have is we're already at about 1,500 players in the transfer portal. Yep. And yep. That transfer portal still has another couple weeks on its deadline. We have no idea what the Big Ten Conference looks like. Just for perspective, about 1,500 players, that's about 30% of the rosters in college basketball. I mean, 30% of players are already on the move. And with a couple more weeks to go, I saw Jeff Goodman say he thinks this could get to 2,000. If it gets to 2,000, we're talking about 40% of college basketball being on the move. So we have no idea. No. And all those way too early things.
They're fun in the aspect of this is what our favorite time of year is. But these rosters are going to be completely day and night different compared to what they are now.
If you're bored just because basketball's done and you don't know what to do, like me, you can click on those, but it doesn't really mean anything because we just have no idea at this point. But speaking of some of the roster movement, Ethan Morton and Mason Gillis, two Boilermakers, hit the portal in this past week. I was curious what you thought.
I'm not surprised by either one of them because both of them came from starters last year and moved to very depleted roles comparatively. Now, Mason Gillis was the first one off the bench. He was the first one to come off. He was the sixth man of the year in the conference. So that tells you that he was still a very big piece to the contribution of the team. But he was a starter last year, as was Ethan Morton. It doesn't surprise me that Morton is in the aspect of the last two times we saw him in the tournament, he literally came in to foul and then was pulled. Like that was his contribution in times that mattered, you know, was we're going to put him in. He's going to foul a couple because we've got a couple of fouls to give. So you might as well. And then, okay, good job. Come on, have a seat. You're going to ride the rest of the way. You know, it doesn't surprise me. He did a great job. He was a defensive master, but I'm not shocked that he's gone. I'm kind of surprised Caleb First didn't step away for as depleted of a role as he had. But
still
he
time. Also,
yes, there's still time, but he is a pre-med. So that is maybe a little different to me. Maybe he made his college choice actually based on the college rather than the program he was going to. So
what a weird concept.
Yeah, he's a weirdo, but that would make his brothers a walk on. So like, there's a chance that maybe he sticks it out and just kind of, you know, understands that his role is what it is, and he sticks around, and occasionally sees the. I think with Zach Edey gone, he'll see a lot of the floor more maybe. Yeah. Not necessarily as a starter again, but because I think honestly, and God love him, I do love Caleb First, but I just think his days as a starter are done at Purdue at least, which is why I'm kind of anticipating or have anticipated that I think Caleb First will leave and maybe find a school that's just as equally as good as pre-med where all of his stuff will transfer over and then he can still get because. He loves basketball. I mean, you don't play basketball at this level and not love it. So he either is going to take this is Purdue. This is, I chose Purdue for my school, for my schooling and what I'm learning, or I'm going to find one that's equally as good and transfer there. So it's tough to tell with with him. But Mason Gillis and Ethan Morton. Gillis is going for his last year of eligibility for his graduate degree. So it's really tough that I don't know the ruling. Like, they get 1 year of graduate ball, and is it? I don't understand the transfer rule on a graduate. Could he have stayed at Purdue one more year?
I'm pretty sure, yeah.
Okay, well, it would have been his sixth. I don't know. He's transferring, and I'm positive it's because of this playing time. And okay, we wrote it out. We got to the national championship game. Okay, I'm transferring out. But I know back in the past, this was the past, if you wanted to play a graduate year, you had to transfer somewhere else. And I didn't know if it was right. The same.
Well, I'm pretty sure he was part of that COVID group. So I think he's got the COVID year.
He was, and I just didn't know. I didn't know which, like, he's graduated, though. That's what I didn't know, because he will be a graduate student now. And I didn't know if that was.
It's a fair question.
Again, with NIL and this transfer portal thing, it is muddied up the transfer rules anymore.
I saw recently that, like, a committee at the NCAA was talking about approving the rule where transfers can transfer anytime and play right away. And I was like, isn't that already happening? Like, what?
They're just officially putting it in as a rule? Is that what they're doing?
But there's 1,500 players. They're playing next year.
Guys, you know what you've been doing for the past 4 years? We're going to go ahead and make that a rule. All right?
I was so confused when I read that. I was like, what? Anybody else paying attention to the portal? Like, I'm so confused.
I was going to say, I mean, you know, Lance Jones, he played right away.
Played right away. I did also want to talk about and examine, look, since Purdue lost to UConn in the national championship game.
You got to keep pulling that Band-Aid off, do we?
Well, we're going to be hearing it for a while, because that means the drought continues for the Big Ten Conference. Yeah. The last time the national championship found its way to the Big Ten was 2000, when Michigan State won it with Mateen and Tom Izzo and the Flintstones. This also marks the 8th national championship game since that 2000 MSU team, and the Big Ten has lost in 8 straight, which is really a fascinating thing. And look, I've talked about this on a couple other programs. I don't believe that this means the Big Ten has choked or underperformed or whatever. But when you really analyze this, Sam, what I find fascinating is, look, this is a completely random tournament, right? Like, March Madness happens, and there's huge upsets, all this stuff, all the time.
See Oakland over Kentucky.
Right. Like, you don't always see the best team make it to the title game. But let's go ahead and analyze those 8 national championship games where the Big Ten fell short. 2002, Indiana against Maryland. Maryland was a 1 seed. They were led by Gary Miller.
And they were an ACC team at the time.
Correct. So, partial credit. But
half credit.
But if we move to 2005, Illinois lost to a 1 seed North Carolina team. That was Sean May, Raymond Felton, Rashad McCants. Man, it's a good squad.
Was Hansborough on that team?
No, he was not.
No, yeah, that's right. Okay.
2007, Ohio State loses to 1 seed Florida. And Florida, that's the year they completed their back-to-back. They were led by Joakim Noah, Al Horford, Corey Brewer, Mo Spates. Like, that's a squad.
Yeah.
2009. Michigan State loses to 1 seed North Carolina. That's the team you're thinking of. Yes. Tyler Hansbrough, Ty Lawson, yep. Wayne Ellington, Danny Green. I mean, just loaded.
Yeah, they were loaded. That was a foregone conclusion, even though Michigan State was playing really well and it was in Detroit. Like, it was anticipated that maybe State can pull it off. No.
North Carolina was an NBA team that year.
They were.
2013. Michigan lost to 1 seed Louisville, led by
No, they didn't.
Since been vacated. But, so that's 2013. Then 2015, Wisconsin lost to 1 seed Duke, led by Jahlil Okafor, Justice Winslow. I mean, another really
is there a better
good
name,
team.
Justice. Justice Winslow.
And then you have 2024, where Purdue loses to 1 seed UConn. I also missed 2018. Michigan lost to 1 seed Villanova, led by Jalen Brunson, Dante DiVincenzo, Mikal Bridges. I mean, that was a loaded team. But look at that. That's all eight of them. Every time the Big Ten has had to play a one seed in the national championship game, and I already could feel the, well, yeah, it's a national championship game. They make it there. But look, it's a random tournament, and if you just follow, like, the law of variance, the idea that every single time you would get there, that you're playing the very best, like, that doesn't quite compute. Like, it's a little right. bit of dumb luck how this has worked against the Big Ten, because not only are they just one seeds and some of the best in tournaments, we're talking about if we were to rank the best teams of the 21st century, a few of those teams I just mentioned are going to be in your top three, right. top five. 2009 North
including
Carolina,
the 2024 UConn Huskies,
who won their games in this tournament by an average of 23.3 points per game. No team has ever walked through a tournament at a higher clip than what UConn just did.
They held a 30-point lead in four of their six games. 30 points. They were ahead by 30 in four of their six. And now you can understand as a one seed the first couple rounds maybe. But when you get to the Sweet 16, you're playing top four, normally top four seeded teams.
Their Elite Eight game, they went on a 30-0 run against Illinois. Yeah.
That's their Elite Eight game to get to the Final Four. Like they were by midway through the second half in most of their game, well, all of their games, including the national championship game, they were on cruise control by then.
Yep.
And I've got a bone to pick with your boy Draymond Green. Zach Edey did not quit in the middle of that game. Did he get frustrated very much? Yes, absolutely did. He did. But he did not quit. At the time that Green said that he quit, he still scored another 14 points after that. So, come on, Draymond. You know, Zach Edey was the only one doing anything because UConn was so good that night.
Correct. Nope, no arguments for
so,
me.
So, Draymond.
But seriously, those national championship games, when you think of that, it's kind of fascinating to see that the Big Ten really just has had some really bad luck.
Oh, for sure.
The Big Ten has yet to have one of those teams this century. That's that overpowering, that's full of NBA talent.
Michigan State was. They weren't full of NBA talent necessarily, but they were that dominant in 2000. Like, they were that team that was just running through it.
And that's the last time we've seen it. And right. and that team did have NBA. I mean, you had Mo Peterson. You had
right, but they weren't all five NBA starters or anything. It was they had a couple of pieces that went in there that did play very well at the pro level, but not everybody. But collegiately, they were just absolutely the most dominating program at that time.
I mean, it's kind of amazing to think though that the Big Ten has just ran into one of those every
yeah.
time. Like, they haven't ran it. If Michigan State beats Butler in the Final Four in 2010, Michigan State could probably beat that 2010 Duke team. Like, that's a susceptible.
Butler almost did, yeah.
Yeah, like, that's a susceptible national champion we've seen this century. That's one the Big Ten needed to be in there for. If Robbie Hummel didn't get hurt, that could have been Purdue's year maybe in 2010. Yeah. Like, when you think about it, the Big Ten hasn't gotten in one of those games and played like a 2010 Duke team. They've played the greatest teams that we've seen whenever they make it there.
I tell you
and
what, that Louisville team that beat Michigan, oh my yeah. goodness. They were loaded. Doesn't matter uh-huh. that it was vacated. It happened. We saw it happen on the court. They Michigan was playing great basketball at that time, and Louisville
and they
just
pushed
absolutely
them.
Yeah, they pushed them. But there was no doubt, like, once you got to the second half, and it was, you could just see Louisville was just kind of like UConn, stretching the lead even further, and you knew they were just going to kind of cruise home.
Yeah.
Did I tell you that I was in Gatlinburg a couple of years after they vacated the Louisville title, and there was a Louisville national champion hat on the clearance rack? I almost bought it just because I'm like, look, it didn't even happen. But sorry.
That's hilarious. like, yeah, no, I thought that was pretty interesting to take a look.
Yeah.
Also, by the way, earlier Sam made the reference to the national championship game being a 9:20 tip.
Ridiculous.
That I was going to say, that brings up another point. I believe we're at a tipping point in this conversation where let's get it together. What are we doing here with a 9:20 tip?
I had to give permission to my youngest to stay up for the first half because the first half got done at 10:45. It was almost 11 o'clock. That's like almost 2 hours after his bedtime. I had to grant him permission to stay up. I was like, you know, you can just stay up, you know, and let him sit next to me and his mom, Joe, you need to go to bed. Yeah, he'll get there. But because this doesn't happen that often, and she knew she was just kind of, but like, you know, Lafayette school districts went on a 2 hour delay. Like their announcement was with the game starting at 9:20 tonight, stay up and watch the game. And then they gave a 2 hour delay for the next day. They had to do that though.
That's how these things should be handled, by the way, when TVs are messing up, like Super Bowl, we should be doing that after.
The day after the Super Bowl should be a national holiday to where nobody goes to work.
Agreed.
You're going to lose more production having people work than just taking the day off.
But a 9:20 tip I thought was ridiculous, and it plays into the part where the ratings came back 14.8 million on average watching the men's game, and this so it gives us the segue. The women with the Iowa South Carolina game, the rating came in for average at 18.9. It peaked at 24 million viewers. That was simply unbelievable.
Is a big part of it, you think? The timing of the start of each, you think? So part of it? Because the women started it at like 5 in the afternoon.
3. They played 3 o'clock.
I'm sorry. They were done at around five.
Yep. So I would say the late tip plays a factor. I would also say, though, you've got to keep in consideration the women's game on a Sunday. Some people still are just living their lives on a Sunday. They're going to be doing their own things. Yeah. Also, the sports games are still ramped up. The MLB played on Sunday. There's a bunch of games happening on Sunday where the sports calendar treats the national championship game kind of like the Super Bowl, where everybody just clears out. And it's just the championship game Monday night. So there wasn't any competition for the men's game.
But it started it. 9 o'clock at night.
Yeah, they just need to kind of make a smarter decision to bump it up, because the amount of people I heard that said they missed it because it was so late. Like, you're missing out on eyeballs just on self-sabotage.
Think about how in the world do you justify it in the aspect of, you know, we haven't had a national champion west of the Mississippi in like 30 plus years or 20 plus years. Most of your people are in the Eastern time zone. Why are we still not taking anything away from the West Coast? And this was in Phoenix, so the game time was at 6:20. Sorry, Phoenix, but you know, you do kind of get the raw deal because a majority of your country watches and lives on the East Coast or in at least the Eastern time zone, to where maybe we need to start this at 8.
And most people that care are Central time and East time.
Well, like, Purdue was playing, UConn was playing. They're both East Coast.
And just in general with college sports.
Correct,
like,
yes.
LA, by and large, can take a flyer on college athletics.
There's a reason why Dodger games are empty until the third inning. It's they don't show up until then.
There's other things to do there. Yeah. This is what we live for here. Yeah. Like,
have you been to the Midwest in the middle of the winter? There's only things to do inside. That's why basketball is a big deal.
Yeah, so I'm totally with it. And I still think you can, even if it tipped at 8 o'clock, 8 o'clock's a different story Eastern time, and that's 5 West Pacific time.
Right, like, my son could have stayed up for the whole game rather than powering through to watch just the first half, and then dragging butt the next day too.
And you take that point and extrapolate it again, that would mean more eyeballs for the game. It just seemed like a really bad job of handling that. And I'm curious if maybe it shifts, because I would imagine if they did some kind of survey, they would actually see that they lost out on having people because of what they did there. And I know this has been a discussion that's as old as time, but
I was going to say, we've been having this conversation for years.
Yeah. It felt more glaring this year, and just hearing the chatter on the street of people saying, I didn't watch because it was so late. I'm curious if that changes. But
it's the first time in a really long time the best two teams in men's basketball had played each other. And here we are starting the game at 9:20. We should have had a lot more eyes. And that's not saying, oh, the women beat the men. It's you had the two best teams playing in the national championship game, and you didn't tip off until 9:20. Actually, it was like 9:22 or 3. But still, the later it gets, the less eyes are going to stay on it.
Yep, 100%. But let's go ahead and talk about the women, because 18.9 million people on average were watching that game. That's the highest recorded basketball game, men's or women's, college or pro, since 2019. It blew apart just about every television record stat. It's the most watched outside of the football and the Olympics since 2019, any sporting event. That's like it crushed everything. It's the most watched women's basketball game. It absolutely crushed the ratings. And look, I know like some people have fun and do the comparison shopping of, oh, it beat the men by 4 million viewers or whatever, and people get defensive, whatever. I just can't believe we're at a point where 24 million people at peak watched that women's championship game. I mean, look, if nothing else, it's just fascinating to watch how this game has evolved and the interest has soared so quickly. Look, the hour-long pregame show, Sam, on ESPN before that championship game, this was tweeted out by Flora Kelly at ESPN, that had 2.9 million viewers. The pregame show to the championship game. You go back 3 years, there was only one women's basketball game that drew more than 2.9 for the game.
2.9.
And now pregame shows.
For a game.
Yeah, like, that was just 3 years ago.
Right.
Like, we haven't seen an ascension for sports popularity with TV ratings quite like this. This is remarkable to see how it's taken off.
This is my question, and it's a serious one. I'm not making light of it. Is it because of the role of the players that were in the roles? Caitlin Clark, 3 years ago, started making her ascension. Now, will it hold? I mean, there's going to be a slight dip at least with Caitlin Clark leaving, but will it stay as high and mandated of an interesting sport for people to watch?
So here's what I find fascinating, because you're right. Like, Caitlin Clark played a big effect in this. Like, there's no doubt about it. People tuned in for Caitlin Clark. And, I mean, all throughout the tournament run, you go to the Elite Eight, over 12 million watched Iowa and LSU. You go to the Final Four, a 14-some million watched Iowa and UConn, and then the championship game we documented. But what I do find interesting, too, you had UConn and USC at about 6.7 million viewers, somewhere in there. You had South Carolina and NC State in the Final Four, north of 6 million or around 7 million viewers as well. Those are games without Caitlin Clark. And look, when you look at the women's basketball game, Juju Watkins is coming back, and she's coming to the Big Ten. Paige Beckers is coming back to UConn. The coaches, here's something I find pretty interesting, too, in what has been, and again, I'm really not trying to do the comparison shopping, but I do find interesting the men's ratings dipped a little bit recently, and we've also seen legendary coaches walk away from the game. Jay Wright has walked away from the game. Coach K's walked away from the game. Roy Williams has walked away from the game. The women, by and large, still have that, even though Tara Vanderveer just announced that she's stepping away coaching at Stanford. But you still have Gino Auriemma. We know Kim Mulkey draws eyes just because of the persona and character everybody tunes in.
Right.
Dawn Staley still at the top of the game. Like, you have these iconic coaches that have star power, and it draws eyes still. And we've seen stars. Like we mentioned, Juju Watkins, Paige Beckers. Like, there are stars for people to still grab onto. I like, to your point, Sam, I wouldn't say the standard moving forward is every game's got to have 14 million viewers,
right,
or it's a bust.
Right.
But if we're talking about a product that's getting 6 million viewers frequently or whatever, it's better than the MLB. Like, yeah, that's still an amazing product. When we're talking about women's basketball, and it probably should outrank America's pastime next year in TV ratings, even without Caitlin Clark, I didn't think we would maybe ever have this discussion. Right. This is unbelievable.
Well, and that was why I asked, because, you know, you got to think that there is a residual effect that she will have. There will probably be a dip. But like you said, if you can stay at a certain, like, I'm sure there's some sort of a not a ceiling, but a floor that people think, okay, as long as we don't go below this, we can say we're actually a competitive alternative or a competitive sport with the men's game. And I don't know. I mean, I'm so new to the women's game in the aspect of following it and really knowing who's who that maybe I didn't know if it was the 3 year, is it going to be cyclical to where we've just got to wait for our next great to come along, like Caitlin Clark, on a team that's not on a not on a team that is a dominant team. So, you know, the Beckers from UConn, the girl from South Carolina that is
Juju
from
Watkins.
South Carolina,
Camila Cardoso
from Brazil. Her, and then Juju Watkins. You know, those are from teams that are established. USC, whether or not you know people know it now, they used to be one of the best programs in the country at the time because Cheryl arguably the best player ever to put on college uniform played there, Cheryl Miller. So I mean, you know, you've got those teams, but Caitlin Clark and people. I heard an argument about Caitlin Clark. Can you consider her a GOAT if she doesn't win the championship? Yes, because look what she did. She took Iowa, who has 3 Final Four appearances in its history, and she went to 2 Final Fours twice or in her time, and she took them to the finals both times. So to me, that's what did she do with a program that hadn't already established themselves? And so, yes, I'm she wasn't on my team, so I'm not a big, hugest fan of her because of just, you know, she's so good that, you know, great, you know, wonderful. My team's going to go get housed by him or whatever. She's going to drop 40 on. That's why I'm not the biggest fan of her. She's one of the best college basketball players to ever play basketball.
Sam, when that fodder started to make its way present in the last couple of weeks, I couldn't help but sit and smile because all I could think of, we really reached equality. These dumbass conversations that we have on men's sports have filtered their way to the women.
They've made it there.
I can't think of a better way for it to represent itself as an actual like thing people are interested in that they want to argue about.
That is one of the dumbest arguments. Well, she didn't win a championship at the college level. So what? Jason Kidd didn't at Cal either, but he's considered one of the greatest point guards to play NBA basketball. Well, he didn't win a national championship, so you can't call him a great. No, he was. Period. I mean,
if you want to argue about who is the absolute best, knock yourself out. But we're talking about somebody who's the NCAA's all-time leading scorer, just shy of 4,000 career points. The phenom she created, all the Big Ten's all-time assist leader. Like, she's absolutely one of the best of all time. If you want to have a conversation about who's number one, period, knock yourself out.
But I may not say she's the greatest ever, but I'm saying she's one of, definitely.
She's up there, 100%. It's so funny though. I couldn't help but smile. I was like, uh-huh. Oh my gosh. Like when you start seeing it on like Fox and ESPN and those talk shows where they just blow gas and that's one of the now things on the table. It's unreal to me.
And I guess maybe that's what you look at is you've really made it when they start making these stupid conversational pieces.
I sat there smiling. I was like, it's happened. Like, I can't think of a better. Forget the 18.9 million people who watch. Forget everything else. If we're having dumb barbershop conversations that are going nowhere about pointless stuff about women and people are getting passionate about it,
more power to it.
We've done.
That's right. Well, and it goes to the same thing. You know, people are like, well, what kind of pro is Zach Edey going to be? I don't care. I'm not evaluating what he's going to do at the pro level. I'm talking about what he's done at the college level. Same thing with Caitlin Clark. She could go in and flop, as I don't think she is gonna, but she could go in and flop in Indiana, and she would still be one of the greatest college basketball players ever to put on shorts, period.
By the way, we talk about the incredible interest that's risen up in women's basketball.
Yeah.
And we talked about sustainability, because I'm curious, and I do believe, like, again, not that you're going to have 19 million every time, but yeah. I do believe you're still going to have a really, really solid foundation of viewers. And there's a real interest in college basketball. But I'm also curious about how this translates to the WNBA, because the WNBA is the draft is coming up here shortly. Everybody assumes Caitlin Clark is going to be.
I was going to say, is it a foregone conclusion she's going number one? Because, like, I've seen advertisements saying that, you know, like NBA WNBA teams have advertised so-and-so, or I forget who it was, but I saw it. Well, they were advertising a game against the Fever, and it already had the Rook, and it was 22.
Versus the GOAT. It was against Taurasi.
That's what it was. Okay, yeah. And a Phoenix against Indiana. I'm like, they haven't even drafted her yet. Have they announced they're going? Now, they're allowed to. They're allowed to say they want to. But my point being is they haven't like started negotiations. Like when was Reggie Bush was drafted number one? Like they were able to, they negotiated with him number one overall, and had a deal in place before they actually officially drafted him, because you're allowed to do that. So Indiana probably could do that, but like they haven't from what I've seen.
Well, and all the marketing started, and they announced their TV schedules. And here's one of the other things I find interesting, because we talk about all these ratings. The Indiana Fever last year had one game broadcasted on national television. They now this year are going to have, 35 or 36?
I saw 34 the last count. 34 okay. of their 40 games.
How insane is that?
What would happen if they go with, what is it, Scalia or whatever from IU?
First pick of the WNBA draft. The Fever select Camila Cardozo.
Yeah, there we go. I'm making light of that. But if she hasn't announced, they haven't announced that, yes, we're planning on taking her. What happens if they're like, yeah, I don't like her, we're going with Cardozo?
There'd be a lot of retracing of steps taking place.
There'd be some renegotiating of those broadcasting schedule.
But it's really unbelievable. And the last couple points I want to make on this before we close out, Sam,
sure.
is, I mean, you brought up with USC, that used to be the thing to watch with Cheryl Miller when she was there. But the problem was you couldn't really watch it. And I'm curious.
Yeah.
Obviously, Caitlin Clark, between her style, between kind of the America's sweetheart persona from Iowa, the Midwest, the whole vibe and everything about it. I'm curious if we had given cable television access of games to Candace Parker's, to Skylar Diggins, to Cheryl Miller's. I think this growth would have happened a long time ago. And I think what we've learned here, based on what we've seen, is that there is an interest here. The problem had been the access and how this just wasn't in front of people or available to people. And now that it's available to people, you're learning that people are interested in investing in this.
I think it's two-pronged though, Dalton, because I've talked to you about when I growing up, I didn't have cable TV, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I was kind of beholden and prisoner to whatever was on. Excuse me, TV at the time. So at the time, the Final Four was the women's Final Four back in the late 80s, early 90s. I was watching it because it was on free TV. I didn't have cable, so I was watching the free TV, right? Mm-hmm. And the women's game of basketball has evolved to be more like, and I'm not saying it is exactly, but more towards the style of the men's, where it's a motion offense. Where it's complete motion and it's more palatable to watch, because before, and I told you about this, it looked like a JV high school game of everybody goes down, set play, you run your set play, it doesn't start, you pull it back and restart and run the set play, another set play again. It was more like that, the women's game. That's not knocking on the women's game. That's not but it went through an evolution to where we're now at a very similar style game that the men play, where it's a complete motion and there's never a set play. It's just you go down, you run your sets, and then eventually, and it becomes more hype, it becomes more palatable to watch, because you've got people moving around and it's not like orchestrated. It's just a complete, you go set picks, you get open, you get or whatever. So it becomes more palatable, and I think that the women have done a great job morphing into that, and then getting these great transcendent players like they've gotten in the past few years that have really brought them to the spotlight. I think it's a couple, you're right on the aspect of they've just finally started getting the exposure, but I think it's because it's become more entertaining to watch rather than watching. I hate saying it, but watching a JV basketball game on a Tuesday night.
I think without doubt, the product's gotten so much better.
For sure.
Talent, the athleticism you see now, like there are full skill sets.
Mm-hmm.
It's gotten way, way better here in the last couple of years.
Agreed.
But I still think back to those days. I mean, that you're talking about. Did you ever think we'd be sitting here and say more people watch the women's championship game than the men's game?
No chance.
And my point isn't just to, I'm not punching down on the men. Nope. My point just is, how unbelievable is it that we got to this spot?
Mm-hmm.
And it's, look, the men are going to outdraw the women quite often, probably.
For sure.
Many, 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 many times in a row from the future. But again, the fact that we got here where 24 million people at one time are watching the women's championship game, when you think back to those days you're talking about, never would have thought this was coming. And so I'm relishing kind of in the fact and the fascination of this rapid growth for the women's game, which is pretty awesome.
Yeah. And that's what I don't want anybody thinking that I'm making light or criticizing the women's game at all. It's a matter of the evolution that we've seen from it that makes it a lot more exciting. And I'm willing to admit that I didn't really like watching women's basketball because it was very, not archaic, but very, very methodical and you had to have a certain set. And that's, so you got these coaches like Auriemma and Pat Summitt to where they're morphing into what we've got now. And now you've got the Dawn Staley's becoming one of the greatest coaches in women's college basketball because now she coaches like she's emotion set. She doesn't have any set plays. They're all, this is what we run. This is our offense. And if you want, we'll make adjustments as need. It's more like the men's game in the aspect of it's more free flow and it's a lot more entertaining in the aspect of a lot can happen in a set in an offensive set rather than a set play from an offense.
The last thing I wanted to mention here too is I was talking with Kim Adams not long ago. Kim Adams is a great broadcaster who's been on just about every single platform and has called some of the games during this NCAA tournament for the women. And she had made the point that as we're kind of soaking in, examining what this is, this moment is for women's sports, women's basketball specifically, to really appreciate, as she said, the fact that this sport did it on its own. Because the NCAA has not really helped women's basketball. I mean, we take shots at the NCAA a lot. They haven't done a lot to invest this. This just was Caitlin Clark and some other star players lifting the sport up, playing it at such a high level, the storylines, everything kind of feverishly catching on to where it bubbled up and boiled to this point. And the fact is, again, I mean, women's basketball did it on its own. The NCAA did not. The NCAA fell into this spot kind of falling into it, luckily. But, like, that's just the women's basketball sport. The game just took it itself and made it into what it is. And that's something pretty cool to appreciate, too.
Think about this, Dalton. Was it 3 years ago that the big report came out was about the amenities at the for the women tournament, women's tournament compared to the men's tournament? You know, that
where you had like a sad dumbbell rack next to
yeah, and the food that was apparently was just night and day comparatively. That tells you what the NCAA or how the NCAA treated the women's tournament compared to the men's. Now, March Madness started in 1979 with Bird and Magic. That was kind of the start of the March Madness, but that was only on the men's side. But at the same time, it doesn't matter that it's been around for 40 years. It should still be these are your student athletes that are representing your organization across the country. And you're treating them like that. Now they've stumbled bass ackwards, as I like to say, into the women's game skyrocketing. Yep. And they better do something to maintain that or they're going to run into bigger problems.
Yep. No, it really is pretty cool to see. I mean, just the fact that they did it themselves.
Absolutely.
Something to really kind of relish.
But one of these times we'll get a Big Ten team winning a national championship, right? We'll have a reason to celebrate.
Last time with the women was 1999, courtesy of the Purdue Boilermakers. That was the actually only time. So yeah, we talked about the men's title drought. The women have lost their last four for the Big Ten. In 2002, right. Notre Dame beat Purdue. 2005, Baylor beat MSU. Then, of course, last year it was LSU beating Iowa, and this year South Carolina beats Iowa again. So,
and no, I do not consider Caitlin Clark to be less of a GOAT simply because she ran into an undefeated South Carolina team.
You know what's crazy is I think in the same time span that we're talking about the Big Ten men and women being a combined 0 for 12 in national championship games,
yeah.
The UConn men and women are a combined 13 and 1 in the same time frame, which is just ridiculous. But anyways, what a sour note to end on. But Sam, you want to let everybody know where they can find us on the way out?
For sure. Well, let me get to that to where I can pull it up. Jeez, I was here reveling in so much other production stuff. So if you want to find us on the TikToks, the Instagrams, and the platform formerly known as Twitter, it is at B1G_talk. That's B1G, Dalton, not B-I-G, B1. Put the one up, yes. B1G_talk, big talk. And if you want to go to Facebook, look up B1G talk, big talk. Don't look up it. It'll come up, but don't click on all big talk. They're great people, I'm sure. I've never met them, but they're not us. So go for big talk. We are on ASAP Network every week, live streamed. And if you miss the live stream and want to find our live stream later through Lounge Media Group, we are on Spotify with our video and anywhere else you find your podcasts.
Yeah, if you're just listening to audio, I just got a haircut. So check us out on video.
I'm
as good as I possibly can.
I've got a nice black hat on. and the reason why I hate IU on. Because the reason why I hate IU is my favorite color is orange, and Keith Smart hit the shot against Syracuse, and Syracuse is wearing their bright orange uniforms, and I was like, nope, I don't like IU anymore.
What a crazy way to fall into this rivalry.
I was seven.
Keith Smart shot that launched. I think that was the first time we ever heard One Shining Moment, too. Was 1987.
I believe you are correct. Yes. Oh, Luther Vandross was still with us at that point.
such a crazy year, 1987. But all right.
First tournament with the 3-point line, too.
Look at that. Wait, all right. Next week's episode, 1987.
You're evaluating the 1987 tournament.
Oh, just teasing. But thank you all to all of you for tuning in and joining us here for this week's edition of Big Talk, College Sports with Midwest Perspective, Blue Collar and Blue Blood. I'm Dalton Shetler. That's Sam Sprunger. So long, everybody.
See ya.